The 580 Show. Let's go. The 580 Show. Let's go. The 580 Show.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to episode 128 of the 580 Show. It took me 128 weeks, but I finally have a guest outside of America. Josh Lancaster, welcome to the show, buddy.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel honored to be the first from overseas.
Yeah. Yeah. We've been talking about it, I think, for a little bit on DMs and just trying to make it work with the time zones and everything. And I think in the history of the podcast, I've shown like bias to American strongman. So I was talking to Luke Davies and he said he recommended you as well and some other guys from the UK. So pumped to have you on, man.
Awesome.
So we're gonna get into a bunch of stuff. We'll get into your coaching. But the first thing I wanted to bring up, and it's funny, it's actually a Q&A. Anytime we post a Q&A for the pod, it's a common theme, and I've never been able to answer it, is the difference between UK and USA for the strongman circuit. Because I don't know if you guys look at our circuit, like our setup as amateur pro class, like is it goofy? And I don't know much about your guys' setup. So like, I thought this would be a really, really good time to kind of like dive into the differences, you know, between the two scenes and explain it a little bit.
Right. I can't really get my head around the amateur and pro thing and the pro card, and I struggle to understand it really the American way. But in the UK, what we'll usually have is qualifiers for each class. So the same classes that feed into say Worlds like OSG and like Arnold's, for instance. So we've got the U80s, 90s, 105s, etc. There's also a 120s class that's taken off in the UK a little bit. That seems quite interesting. But generally there's regional qualifiers that you'd have to enter. So in terms of, yeah, I suppose like for people listening in the USA, like the UK is essentially the maybe the size of a state. We did the Arnold's in Ohio recently, and like looking at the Ohio as a state in terms of scale, it's like the whole size of the UK. So England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, all into one. So how it usually works is the say England, for instance, would be split up into usually like a north and south qualifier. And then at worst, people usually would have to travel maybe two to four hours usually driving. Oh, wow.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So even like, even say national competitions, like people, you'll only usually have to travel maybe between 2 and 5 hours or something, or 2 and 4 hours to go to like a national comp. So I imagine that's like massively different to the US, and obviously comes with, I imagine it's quite problematic in the USA in terms of people have got to be able to afford to travel, haven't they? In terms of, you know, if you're traveling to the other side of the states, like it's the obviously the cost of travel to factor in, but time off work, right? So I think it is quite a interesting dynamic, I suppose. But yeah, that's how it happens in the UK, and then the top X amount would qualify to say English championships, like say England's Strongest Man, England's Strongest Woman, and then the top, say whatever 3 to 5 would usually qualify to Britain's, and then that'd bring the best from Wales and Scotland and Ireland together as well, and then I don't know if they're actually affiliated with OSG to get like a direct qualifier to the kind of Europe's or World's route or whatever. But yeah, that's the general pathway.
Yeah. So is it like Like, is it like a federation? Like one person, like when you say like Britain's Strongest Man, or is it kind of just like agreed upon, like
No, it's a joke. It's a joke, honestly. Like the yeah, it's just a fucking Wild West. It's crazy. People, essentially, me and Luke Davis proved it a couple of years ago with the bringing the U80 scene in the UK. Like there was a bit going on for the 105s and under 90s that was decent, but the under 80 scene was dead. And I suppose like we came together. Just, I remember being at his gym one day, and like he said, "Oh, should we put on an under 80s comp?" And I said, "Right, let's do it. Let's make it the best show that this country's ever seen in terms of the weight classes." People, but like the resistance we were up against, people said to us, like, "There's no under 80s in the country. Nobody's interested. We've tried the shows. People just aren't interested in doing it." So I personally saw that as a challenge. I thought it's the system that is wrong, like, or the system that could drastically be improved, and that's the reason why people haven't fed into the comps, not because there aren't willing competitors there. So then we came up with the system, I suppose, inspired by Furman doing Clash, I suppose, was that me and Luke both agreed that we weren't bothered if we lost a bit of money and had to invest a bit of money ourselves just to kind of at least give potential for the under 80 scene to spark up again in this country. So we decided on the idea of putting 50% of the entry fees, because obviously things cost money to organize and stuff, but I have like a ridiculous amount of strongman kit. Luke has that, so obviously that's a big thing. We could just use our own kit, for instance. We have loads of people in our network who are like keen to help us, so that was another good thing. But we put up the 50% of entry fees to directly back into the athlete's prize pot. So, and the other thing that worked really well for it and that attracted loads of people to enter was the fact that we put different weight options that people could either pick like 8 kilo log or 110 kilo log, for instance. So basic, and then we sold it to people in terms of where the elite guys. Or say the better guys in the UK, you know, like people like Flash, people like Dean McVie, Tim and Joe Dalgleish. It was a way that they didn't have to lift lighter weights. They could go heavy and essentially prepare them for feed them into the internationals. But then the people whose barrier was they weren't quite strong enough yet was completely eliminated. And then we kind of fed it into these people who were kind of would want to be a part of it, but were a little bit scared, you know, maybe due down to experience, the new to it or whatever. But we broke down that barrier by said, look, even if you come in zero every event, which you probably won't do anyway, but even if you come in zero every event, your money is directly supporting these guys who you are inspired by, and you're feeding into you. Being part of this mega show, but also you're feeding into the helping the other guys prepare. So that was a really good kind of way of removing that barrier. And there were so many people who were kind of new to it, new on the under 80 scene, who were just like, yeah, I'm in. Like, let's support the guys at the other end. And then the guys at the top, we put records on and stuff, like the Max Deadlift, Max Dumbbell. Max Stone Run ended on the heaviest stone that had been done. So yeah, we kind of got that back on it. But my point is, we called it Britain's Strongest Man, and now we've got like kind of we got sponsored by Official Strongman. We got Sir they covered it. We got there was like a good sponsorship deal that came with Cerberus off the back of it. There was Spartan Atlas Stones. They came forward and provided the stones for us. Rebel Strength, the dumbbell that I use to this day in training, Rebel Strength gifted us that dumbbell to for the comp to go for the record. So because we kind of put ourselves out there and we're prepared to lose money, like it was amazing in terms of the sponsorship opportunities that came forward and jumped on board with us. So yeah, it was brilliant. And then Luke's I was just getting like really anxious like hosting comps and stuff. So I stepped away from it really and just focused on coaching and competing myself. But like Luke's continued with that, and it's just snowballing and growing. But the point is, back to the original question, we called it Britain's Strongest Man. We just fucking made it up, really. You know what I mean?
Spoken
We
into
just
existence.
made it up, and we're like, well, if you can put on a better show than us, you can call it whatever you want. Let's see what the athletes want to do, and let's see who recognize it as the show. And yeah, I suppose that's what we've done. But yeah, the point is, like, anybody can do that. And unfortunately, it seems, it may be speaking out of turn here if any English guys are listening to this, but like the under 90 scene, there's been like another federation that's set up this year in the under 90s, like a different pathway to a different name, Brits, for instance. And the original pathway that's been around for years, like I won the title of England's Strongest Man under 90 2021, and like I was so proud of that. That was like my biggest achievement to date, probably. Actually, some of the guys that I beat on that day. But that pathway is like it hasn't really kind of developed and evolved with the times, like in terms of like you might be lifting on head to head with different logs, for instance, or the sport's really developing and moving on, and which is brilliant. But there's some promoters seem stuck in the ways in terms of, and I don't mean that from a negative perspective. Like I'm just observing that what they've done for years isn't quite good enough anymore. So there's like people who have brought the like created other federations, and even though it doesn't immediately have the prestige because people j immediately just see it as like, oh, it's just another pathway. Like the feedback that I've had from my clients who've done this like kind of new pathway has been absolutely brilliant, and so much that I requested to for like a wild card invite to the England's under 90s that's next month, and I'm really excited about it. I'm really looking forward to it, because like the feedback was the show was like they cared about the athletes, the refereeing was good, the events were nice and varied, like it was professionally run, like the plenty of warm up, plenty of warm up opportunities at the facility, plenty of facility for spectators and stuff. So yeah, back to the original question. It's just like it is the fucking Wild West. But there's opportunity there if somebody's good and they put on the there's like we could, you and I could make up a show. And if it's brilliant, absolutely brilliant, like people like say Lynn would work with Lynn at say OSG would work with us. Like if we're proving that we're putting the fucking the best athletes on the planet together because we are because we they're drawn to us and the kind of comfortable by how much we care and how much we kind of know that, like how we're up to date with the current goings on. Yeah, it's not just we're not just saying, oh yeah, we do it this way because that's how we did it 10 years ago. It's like, yeah, it's look, I've got my World's Strongest Man hat on here. Look, what does it say? Established 1977. This is where a lot of people go wrong with strongman. They think, oh fucking hell, this is the way we've always done it. Like the sport is so young. The sport is so young. It's not like, say, even weightlifting or powerlifting or bodybuilding, like that have been around like longer, like
And even since 1977, how much has it changed? You know, like for the
exactly.
better, you know what I mean? Like it has changed, and
Exactly.
every good sport, evolves. And that's just how it works. So yeah, I mean that's a great point. I
Yeah,
think.
that's the thing. And but like we appreciate it. Like, look at how animated I am talking about this, right? We're excited about this. Yeah, we're excited about, like, every year. Like, I look back to 2 or 3 years ago and think, fucking hell, like, how much are things developing? Like, in this country, like, there's loads of opportunities for, say, weight classes. Like, the women last year had to go at, like, say, Giants live shows, and like the feedback was amazing. So the women's side is growing, and then the other federations are kind of pulling the finger out, and like everything's developing.
Yeah.
So I think it, and like I'm so happy to be, like you are, I'm sure, like being part of this revolution.
Yep.
But it's just a shame that some people are stuck in the ways and are resistant to the change. And I think if they just actually put it in perspective and just think, the reason why it's changing so much is because it's so fucking new. Like, people think that the optimum way to lift a buddy, whatever, 12 years ago, 15 years ago, maybe there's a more commonly executed better way to do it now.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe we've still, like that's the thing that I do with my coaching and my training and stuff, is like I've learned how to be a competitor and a competitive athlete without being I didn't get into this because I was strong and suited to it. Like, I'm not like I come from like a kind of sport background, playing tennis, football, anything competitive. So I come into this sport being a competitor, not being necessarily suited to be like good at lifting heavy weights, for instance, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean.
So I've found ways how to, I've stolen things from different sports to be like, right, well, fuck me, like, it's going to take me ages to build loads of muscle, to get big and strong, to produce a lot of force to lift this. But what if I lifted it in a more efficient way? Like, what can we take from track and field? What can we take from sprinting? What can we take from weightlifters? What can we take from CrossFitters? What can we take from, and yeah, I suppose stealing the best things from other people.
That's how you do it, right? I think just to rewind a little bit, I think we see that in the States too, is like older people that have been around since like the parking lot days, the parking lot shows and stuff like that, that don't want to change and are really resistant to change and kind of trying to slow down the evolution of the sport. I think we see that here too. But we have so much opportunities for strongman in the USA where you can go do a show literally any weekend. Before Christmas, after Christmas, any time of the year, I think the really good promoters, the people that are like going above and beyond, like you mentioned, like you and Luke, are like they're gonna rise to the top, and some of these older shows are gonna kind of like, the competitor. You leave it up to the competitors. They are the people spending the money to sign up to register and stuff. So, wherever they go is probably whatever the better show is, and whoever's putting on the.
Yeah, that's it. Shout out to Luke and Chaos Strength Promotions. Like,
Yeah.
I suppose, as a speaking from a co coaching pers well, speak from both perspective. As an athlete perspective, like, if I want to, say, have a run out and just go and do a practice comp for bigger shows or whatever, like, and Chaos have one run it, like, I'll go and do it. I've done loads of comps there myself, and it's just that kind of mental. I don't know, the mental side of like being excited for a comp, but you know what it's like going to a comp and you think, oh, fucking hell, I don't want to feel like I'm deflated and let down. And how many times have you gone to competitions and you've been like, oh, fucking hell, that's a bit of an anticlimax. Like, it was the show was too long, or we didn't get a warm up, or the events changed on the day, or the refereeing was ambiguous. Like, whereas you go to Chaos, it's simple. They're sharing the same values as you. Like, they want to get through the day. They don't want to have you there all day waiting around. Like, they want to get through it. It's consistent. It's a great experience, whether you're an elite athlete or whether you're somebody new getting into the sport. It's just absolutely brilliant. So yeah, it's great from a coaching perspective. It's brilliant for me feeding athletes into that. It's great. It's great
Yeah.
from a coaching perspective because like I can get my athletes into that, and I know that they're going to have really likely to have a really good experience, which in turn is obviously better for the coaching because they're going to want to improve and better for coaches' retention and stuff. So it all feeds into each other. And then you look from the elite standpoint that you look at, have you seen the roster for the under 90 classic that Luke's put up? And
Yeah.
and
Crazy.
like the what that's called, the Chaos Under 90 Classic. That's an example. It's just a
Right.
fucking it's just a made up name. Yeah, it could
Yeah.
be like it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's drawn people from people from the USA to come to the UK, people from Australia to come to the UK, people from Europe to, and it's got like a phenom like it's cr crazy.
It's a
Like I
crazy roster. Crazy roster.
that's it. Like I'm so excited to compete in that and feel like I'm going to be like really find my level against the best.
Right.
Yeah, and I hope everybody does it who's on that roster because it's great. But like yeah, so an example of like you put the like say what he's done is put the prize pot up, and it's not, and it's much more than the prize pot and the sponsors. It's the brand that he's built, him and Ree, in the last couple of years in terms of executing consistently brilliant competitions at every level of the sport. And it yeah, it's just brilliant.
Yeah. So you obviously you have a you can tell just listening to you in the last like 15 minutes or so that you're very passionate about strongman, obviously. What's some stuff in strongman that you may like that you hate, like a trend that's going on that you think needs change, like something that needs changed that you hate, something that you think needs added to like just to say like I know that's a tough loaded question, but like trends,
Yeah.
like are there any
There's something that
trends
I
that
hate. Something that I hate. Let's think about it. People who document how they're feeling about the sport generally and like moaning about it and being like that they've got to go to a dark place to complete a session, or they've got to, and I'm sorry if this offends anybody, but like it's maybe because I just can't relate to it, but I just feel that people who like use that kind of who basically fucking moan about the sport and training and just don't seem like they're enjoying it, but then they just keep doing it. I
they're
just
still
think it's
doing
fucking
it.
ridiculous.
I feel that.
But
That's a good one.
I just think, I don't fucking do it. There's
Yeah.
lo there's lo there is loads of things in life, and it doesn't even have to be sport that can give you fulfillment and satisfaction. Like, don't be forcing yourself to do this. Like, and if you're
Yeah.
stuck and you don't know what to try, just like message me. I'll go and draw, go and do some art or something, or
Yeah,
go
yeah.
and I don't know.
No,
I don't
that's
know. It
funny you mentioned that.
really frustrates me.
I was listening to a podcast. I was talking to someone about this. I was listening to another podcast the other day, and the people on there were like, how often, at almost once a week or something, they said, I have to drag myself into the gym to like wanna go lift. And I was like, I feel so fortunate because in the 10 years or whatever that I've been enjoying powerlifting, strongman, whatever,
Yeah.
I'm still to this day, I'm so excited for every session. Like, even if I'm just doing like speed deadlifts, like I realize how lucky I am, like how much I love this and like I want to be doing it and it makes me happy. So like if I didn't like it, I wouldn't do it. You know what I
Yeah.
mean? So that's a good point. I think that's interesting that people like.
That's the thing. Like we do like speaking in the context of doing strongman as a sport. We're fucking, we're pissing about. We're playing. We are playing. So if you're not playing and having fun, and people say, oh yeah, you put like pro cards and they're fucking, there are very few people making a career, speaking from the UK perspective, in solely competing.
Yeah, I mean, is there 10 people in the world? You know what I mean? Maybe.
There's yeah. Look at the like. I went to World's Strongest Man last month. Amazing. And you look at the roster there, and like people are just like the people are working normal jobs. Like they're not doing it as a like it's going to be great when it's oh it's shown in your country this weekend, isn't it? I think
What is?
World's Strongest Man. I think
Oh,
it.
it's being shown. Yeah. I think this is finally the weekend that it's that we can
Yeah.
find out who won because we don't
But
know who
you'll
won.
see like the crowds there, like it's just amazing.
Yeah.
And these guys are the top of the like top of the tree. And a lot of them are going back to work on Monday.
Yep.
Yeah. So
Crazy.
but my point being that if you do like that, they've got to be doing it because that like you've got to be enjoying it. You've got to be having fun. Like you're playing. Most of us are playing, and it's a sport. So if you're playing, you've got to be enjoying it. Like just fucking do something else. Like if you genuinely feel negative about it, like just go and do
Yeah,
something else.
a hundred
Loads
percent.
of, but like there are so many things that I want to do. I want to play. I want to play tennis. I miss playing soccer. I want to play golf, but I don't because I enjoy doing this just that little bit more.
Right.
But the point is enjoyment. And if I wasn't enjoying it, I'd just fuck it off.
Yeah. Don't take our sweet. I think a lot of athletes kind of need to hear that message because it's like, don't. We all want to compete. We all want to do our best. We all want to win, right? I mean, that's just human nature. However, don't take yourself so serious. Like, you're going to have
Yeah.
bad comps, stuff like that. Because, like you said, in the grand scheme of things, there may be 10 guys in the entire world, 10 guys and girls that are making a full-time living off this out of thousands and thousands and thousands of people. So have fun. You know, I think that's a good message.
Yeah, that's a good point what you just said to reiterate, and that's a ma mantra I live by is like I've forgotten what I was going to say. Took like there's no I don't feel like in the moment there is nobody that could take it more seriously than me, like in terms of in the moment I'm stepping up to like literally every rep of every set that I do in practice is max focus and intent. Yeah, but like outside of the lifting, like I couldn't take it any more seriously. But in terms of myself, I don't take myself seriously whatsoever.
Yeah.
Like I'll be like it's just you know, like if I go and finish and I come last at a comp or whatever, I'm not feeling like I need to justify myself or whatever. I just feel like oh fucking hell, I was shit today. Boom, move on to the next thing. And I think that having that kind of mindset and developing that mindset, I do think it's a learnable skill. And I think it's really important, really valuable if you can learn how to do that for the longevity of any endeavor, really, like in any kind of sport or anything. Like that's how I can see myself doing this long term. Is because like actually I just take the rough with the smooth. Like I take it really seriously when I'm in the moment, but just take the rough with the smooth. Win a trophy, win a title, set a record. It don't fucking matter, does it? Like it matter ma like at all. You go to work the next Monday, nobody cares. Nobody gives a fuck. So stop beating yourself up about it. Whereas like when I was younger, and this way I think it's a learnable skill. Is like when I was young, like playing tennis or whatever, I used to take myself too seriously. Like, I must have smashed like 30, 40 rackets over the course of playing because I wasn't in tune with switching off and not taking myself too seriously. And I just thought, like, oh yeah, I don't know. Just.
It makes sense. Makes sense. I think that's a good message for people to hear. I know I've needed to hear it in the past couple of years, you know, myself as an athlete, so I'm sure other people do as well. But so I really didn't even introduce you other than your name, but Josh Lancaster, and you were the first person under 80 to hit a 100 kilo circus dumbbell in comp. And a whole long list of achievements. You mentioned UK's in 21, right? And
I'll just correct you on that actually. So it wasn't in a comp. So this is a like a debate going on, isn't it? That's be quite interesting to chat about if we have time.
So that
But
was so that wasn't in a comp when you did it?
no, it was a standalone lift, like an exhibition kind of lift or whatever. But it was like in the middle of England's Strongest Man final. It was like I did like a sixth event, if you
Yeah,
will.
you did like a showcase lift basically, like
Yeah, it was like
after.
I did like 120 kilo axle for reps. I think I did four reps, and then I did like I think it might have been like 255 kilos, 15-inch axle deadlift for six reps in the competition. And
Yeah.
then I went and did the dumbbell whilst people were resting kind of thing in between
Gotcha.
events.
And
So I just
like didn't Luke Davies still judge it? So it was like judged up to standards, but it wasn't. Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
That's
no, and like
interesting.
weighed in and like the idea was go for what I thought at the time was like the biggest pound for pound single arm dumbbell of all time. Oh, can you see it? Oh, no, there's a picture.
And it's a really cool video. Like if you go to Josh's Instagram, I think when I was looking at your Instagram, you have it pinned up at like the top. And it's a really cool video because you hold it for so long at the lockout and like you can just tell like how excited you are about it. So it was
Yeah, it's good. So, what was it? What did I weigh in at? I think I weighed in at seven. I think it was 78.8 kilos that I weighed in at. So the idea was what I thought was if I broke the record, I think it was 96.9 by Flash. I think it was maybe. So I just chipped at that. I think I did like 97.4 or something first, and then I wanted to go for the 100 and be the biggest pound for pound of all time, which I thought it was. But then Nick Myers pointed out afterwards that I assumed that hit when he did, was it 114? Like I'd worked it out as he'd done 114 at under at 90,
Yeah.
divided that by that, and like so it was similar. But yeah, it was good,
Yeah,
decent.
that's awesome. England's Strongest 21, right?
Yeah, under 90, and
Under
then
90.
came second at the under 80s the year after, which was when I did the dumbbell thing,
Yeah.
and then I won the a European Arnold's comp that last year in September that qualified me for the Ohio,
So
so
what was
that.
it? So what's it like? Like, I've never had to travel that far for a comp. I hope to one day. But when you came to Columbus, Ohio this year, you competed in the 90s. You were originally supposed to compete with me in the 80s, but I think you had like some deadlift and stuff or something like that.
Oh yeah, I just re when that Ukrainian deadlift got announced, I
Yeah.
realized that even like I can't even get a podium. Like that's what I thought in my head. Like even if I got like I'd qu aim to qualify for the final day, which I felt pretty good on the event, but then I was just like, I'm going to be sitting the deadlift out.
Yeah.
So that's what was so excited about the Arnold's this year was because there wasn't a deadlift announced. So I thought, fucking hell, like I can get away with my injury, if you will.
Yeah.
So when I just when I thought that there's no way I can get on the podium anyway, I just thought there's no point putting myself through the weight cut.
Yeah. So what's it like? What was it like coming to the Arnold? It in the USA, and how did you think? Like, are there any main differences doing a show? And I mean, you've done OSG, right? Have you done O? Yeah, I see the shirt right behind you. So you've come to the USA to compete before. Is there any like main differences you've noticed, like coming over here versus doing a show in the UK?
Yeah, I think it's fucking hard, like cutting weight. I think that's a massive thing with the long haul flights. I think that is like massive respect to anybody who does it and performs well.
Yeah.
You know, where D McVee this year, he came, where did he come third at OSG?
Which
Sorry, last year.
is crazy. Like,
Yeah,
does it
respect.
bother? I mean, and he's an incredible athlete. It's crazy. You were mentioning like the UK is like the distance of whatever, like a state in the USA. But if you look like just look at just the 80s, for example, because that's the class I'm most in tune with, is there's some pretty incredible athletes there, for on the world level, for being a smaller area. Does it bother you guys that like overseas athletes that OSG is like considered worlds? I think everyone kind of considers it worlds, right? For weight classes, like undoubtedly. And does it bother you guys that it's always in the USA?
Yeah, definitely. Because and I don't want to how can I word this and not sound like a fucking somebody who makes excuses? But I'd be really, really interested to see how and I'm not doubting that they'll do well, but I'll be interested to see if how the USA guys and Australia guys or whatever who are traveling to the under 90 classic, how they get on, and if any of them are kind of performances affected by the longer traveling.
Yeah, well, if you look at we're weight class athletes too. Like historically, World's Strongest Man traveling, like yeah, I'm sure it's tough for the supers to travel, but if you look at a weight class athlete, they have a lot more stress to deal with being in a weight cut, because
Yeah, for sure.
you're typically traveling in the heat of like the most stressful part leading up to the
That's
competition,
it.
right?
And then do like travel flying on Virgin Atlantic, and they bring in round like beer and wine, and I just usually get steaming on the way, but I can't do that if I'm
Yeah.
away. Or like but yeah, that's definitely a massive fact. Like that is the hardest thing about like say competing internationally. And there's the except the I mean from my England to USA or whatever.
Yeah.
But then again, like I might be talking shit because you look at Ben Donan, he smashed it. Similar traveling to us. He's absolutely smashed it. Smash Clash and Worlds. Yeah, absolutely brilliant. So
With the show, like the way the shows are ran, like just take the Arnold for example,
yeah.
is it much different, like the actual logistics of the show versus like what you would see it like over there?
No, not really.
Pretty
Not
similar.
yeah, pretty similar, I'd say. Yeah, I thought it was pretty good.
That's cool. So
OSG's a bit like is it seems a bit drawn out, but it's like that for everybody, isn't there? Because the like, yeah.
the
But
money.
and also I understand why OSG is in the USA, like logistically, like traveling around the world, like the benefit that you get from it being in the same-ish
Right.
place. Is that that like Lin runs a phenomenal show, and like you look at some of the stuff that he had to deal with last year, with the weather and stuff,
Yeah, which is crazy
how they
that they're able
adapted,
to, yeah, able
it's
to
brilliant.
overcome it.
They're doing shit like that when they're organizing a comp in Russia or organizing a comp in Spain or whatever, where they don't look like,
Yeah.
yeah. Just a
No,
logistical nightmare, and the language barrier as well, like in other places. Although I do feel like there would be it would be a good show in the UK.
yeah. I like you said, I 100% get it because Lynn has all that equipment. Like, let alone just getting the equipment to the UK would be hard. I mean, he's got like the patented like the car yokes, right? Like just think about like the Vikings, all that stuff. That's a nightmare. And I know that you're gonna have the most participation from USA athletes, just the way it currently is laid out. But I 100% would be a fan and would understand if it was overseas in the next couple of years. And I think it should be, because I think if you get in the habit of every single year being in Daytona or Charleston or wherever it's going to be in America, you start to lose the allure of Worlds, because it's like, well, it's only America, and I get
And
it.
also as well, like there's this perception of Like it makes you look at the Arnold's roster, look at who was at the Arnold's, you look at OSG, and it's all like USA guys. And a lot of it is down to opportunity. Like I know some really, really good guys who just got like, you don't want to say the name because it's private, but they can't fucking afford to pay a couple of £1,000 to go and travel and be away from, and like the opportunity costs of earning money. Like it's just not practical and too expensive. I suppose my point would be, because it is obviously it's expensive for everybody, but if it was free and all subsidized and we were all professional athletes, I'd say, like I suspect the order of results would be significantly different. That's what I'm saying. I don't mean like the top people, but like say the top 30 at OSG. The people at the Arnold's, like it would be represented significantly differently. Whereas a lot of people can like major see the, like you look at the best shows and the results, and all USA guys are all fucking savages in terms of results. But how much is down to like there's some really good UK guys at all levels. One in the one that seems like this is the under 105 class actually in the UK. Like that's probably that's the most underrepresented class in terms of internationals, and it's just there's some really good guys that compete, but they just don't seem to. It might be I don't know personally what the issue is, but it's a big commitment for
I mean, it's a
a
lot
way
of money.
that somebody that like me can justify it is because like I'm a like win, lose or draw for me, it don't fucking matter because I can document it and it adds to my brand and my presence and my coaching or whatever. You know, I can't lose. So it's an like I go there and it's an investment for me. But when people are just doing it just for the sake of competing as an athlete, then like, I can see why more people don't. Like it's a significant barrier, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. It goes back to what we were talking about. There's 10 people on earth that are making money from it. If you can do a show 2 hours from your house versus go 12 hours of flying and spend $5,000, some people have to be realistic with their financial situations, and everyone's in a different spot.
There's one of the guys I train with is a fucking animal. And would do like be a competitive open, but he won't even pay the official strongman fee to for the online qualifiers because of the it's another financial commitment. So there's people like I suppose he's a big exception really, but there's lots of talent out there that would be physically that could represent a really decent level that aren't doing just because of the barriers to entry as opposed to being capable. I suppose that's what I'm saying.
That
Which
makes sense.
I'm just doing what I hate doing and highlighting a problem there, not offering a solution. I'm saying I'm not criticizing anybody for doing it or anything, any kind of way of running, because I don't know what the solution is. Like going back to the thing of it being a new sport, we haven't
I
got
think
the there isn't really money at
yeah.
the top to reinvest, is there? So
Right. I think it, for just look at Lynn, for example, and I mean, I'm sure he has thought about everything that I have and more. But I think the way that he would have to do overseas would be to pair up with someone like Luke Davies, for example, and put a lot of the boots on the ground stuff on Luke and show up a week or two early and have to kind of trust him that he has like the kit, everything, the venue's good, all that stuff. And I think that's how you'd have to do it. But as from a like not from a comp I like it being in the US as a competitor, right? When because I'm gonna want to go this year, but I would love to see it overseas in the next year or two because I think I would like to see other athletes be highlighted and see, because maybe your theory is wrong. Maybe USA is just gonna do good at the show no matter what. But I think there's one way to find out. So I think you have to.
Yeah, I think it would be really good. But yeah, do you think that that's a consistent barrier there? I'll take my girlfriend's a good example. She competes. She did the Arnold, and she did the she's doing OSG Europe's, and they're paying like whatever. She if I talk to her about strongman and logistics, she just switches off. She couldn't care less, honestly. She just likes to train, and fucking when we come home, she hates talking about anything to do with strongman. And so I don't get to voice and like discuss anything with her. But I can tell from a pure consumer perspective, like just a like she sees the thing of I think it's like £150 entry fee or something for OSG Europe's. It's a lot of money, and you can see a lot of people think, oh my goodness, like the entry fees are ridiculous. Like, where's all this money going? They're going to be like Lynn's, like pocketing it all and going on holiday with it and spending it all and splashing the cash and spending it all himself. Whereas, like, I can see that everything's just getting, it's just, he's just trying to snowball and reinvest it. And there's no money at the top to kind of feed that. There's no kind of major kind of sponsors that somebody's not just turning up with £1 billion to invest in the sport. Like,
It makes sense. Yeah, I know what you're saying. I mean, and it's like you can look at like the professional sports model, like over here in the US, and I'm not trying to talk shit, but like the WNBA wouldn't be paid if the NBA didn't exist. And
right.
that's much more of like a grander because the money's just not there as far as viewership, going to the events, stuff like that. Where but they have this feeder at the top, like you're mentioning, and it's able to feed down and kind of make the sport as a whole grow, which is awesome, and make it flourish. So I see what you're saying. We're just on a much smaller scale, but yeah, that's all good stuff. I don't want to end the pod without talking about your coaching. So British Strongman Coaching, right?
Yeah, I've built a YouTube channel with loads of just bit. I've just been coaching for years and years, I suppose. Well, sorry, about 10 years now doing the strength coaching. And just, I mean, like the thing that's bothered me is the amount of magical stuff that's happened over the years that I just haven't. I don't mean in terms of people winning stuff or whatever. I mean, like,
Right.
when you're in a training session and you might say to a buddy, oh, we'll try this cue or whatever, and then it just kind of changes everything. I suppose like my passion the last couple of years has been like trying to capture these moments and then document via like YouTube and social media, and the result's been that I've been able to help like loads of people at scale without for free. Without it costing me loads of time, because I'm like making these videos and these kind of resources and stuff that, yeah,
Yeah.
that's what I've kind of done with that channel that.
We are like if you're watching on YouTube right now and people on the that are just listening on Spotify or Apple, they'll be able to see your Instagram name, but I would highly recommend going and following Josh because he puts out a ton of good strongman content where he does voiceovers, talks coaching through lifts, events, stuff like that, and it's there's a lot of really good content. Even the other day, I think, didn't you put the thing up about the power stairs, sliding it
What
down?
about other the step the using the slide?
Dude, that was like, I was like, holy shit. I sent that to like five people. I'm like, this is like the dumbest thing, but it's so smart. Like it was it, like little stuff like that. That's why I like following good coaches like you and just good athletes. 'Cause like little stuff like that just makes my training easier. And I thought that was because I'm about to start training power stairs for a show coming up in July. And I'm like, wow, that just made my life so much easier.
Yeah, that's it. And I suppose that's the difference of having like I suppose I pride myself on being a coach first and foremost, and like when I started coaching and like say doing well with athletes winning competitions, I wasn't even doing strongman. I was still like playing football, tennis or whatever. Did like a bit of powerlifting, bit of weightlifting too. I was just bothered about getting other people better. But then it got to the point where some people were like kind of questioning me and saying like, "Oh, what do you what?" So then I just started to compete because I thought, right, well, I'm shit at all these things, but if I go and apply these things that I go and get other people to do, then I'll just show that anybody can do it and anybody can get competitive and get good. So that's kind of what I've done with myself is got like I've literally struggled with every lift across the board, and I've just like kind of got better to prove my coaching concept really. So
Cool.
that's a different like I'm speaking from a kind of theory perspective in terms of you know somebody who coaches from reading a book and then going to tell somebody to do it, but also I've like got skin in the game in terms of I know what it feels like to be training fucking power stairs by yourself and like just like m m more efficient ways to get the practice in and you know knowing what things feel like and what's going through your head when you're doing certain things. I think it's very valuable.
Right on. Right on. Is there anything you want to talk about with your coaching, like in advance to that? I mean, I think that's cool to have. I think that's a really good point about having a coach who has skin in the game, like you mentioned, because theory is great, but actually having real world application is really, really important. So I think that's good you mentioned that.
Cool. Do you have 10 minutes?
Yeah,
Yeah,
absolutely.
10
You
minutes.
got
All right.
10 minutes. It's
Can I
really, yes.
go over? Right, I want to just go over a couple of pointers that are basically the principles that I've realized that when I'm coaching the basic lifts that are subtly different. Some of them are subtly different to what I heard when I was new to strongman, for instance, and I suppose how I've adapted and compressed them into the most simple ways possible. So I'll talk about the pillars that I teach. So they're a little bit on deadlift, a little bit on overhead, a little bit on moving events, a little bit on loading events. So very general. You can take what I say with a pinch of salt, but there might be something in there that you can go and apply to your training. And yeah, just let me know how it goes. So I'll give you three pointers on each. Basically, I've tried to c compress it down to three most simple, but basically this look at it as like the smallest hinges that open the biggest doors in terms of optimizing your technique. So talk about the deadlift. So the thing that I think people should be focusing on from scratch and also right up to elite level is focusing on bar path as number one and basically getting your bar path perfectly straight. And it might seem perfectly obvious to a lot of people listening, but a thing that obviously I can only talk about, say, experience in the UK, but the big things in the UK are people seem to be obsessed with trying to keep your back straight and just really focusing on that as like the priority number one in terms of lifting, where they come and people are just so distracted by keeping the back straight that the bar path is just completely inconsistent. So what happens when we're talking in the context of strongman is when you're adding a competition element to it. And like, how often do you see it in the USA where you see people that they have seemingly really nice technique with, say, 30% of the max, but then they go to a competition and then their positions are all over the place and they just kind of turn a blind eye to it almost. Like, is
Right,
that something
right.
that you see?
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I just see that just in the gym alone, like owning a gym, like, it's easy to make light weights look good, but when you're at that competition weight or a maximum, 90% plus, yeah, that's when it goes to shit and, stuff breaks
That's
down.
it. So I work. I try to work backwards from that. I always think with somebody, say a strongman athlete, right? They go, let's look back at your competition, last competition. You're like, you were hitching and grinding and ramping the final rep or whatever. You're because you backed rounded as you can't pick, you can't maintain the position from the floor anymore or whatever. So then you're being pulled everywhere. But the point being that they're going to go to this, and you've got to respect as an athlete, they're going to go to these positions anyway. Like they're going to push themselves to that, sorry, not the position, but they're going to push themselves to that limit anyway. So what I kind of work backwards from is like once they've nailed the bar path and got it perfectly straight as a non-negotiable, then I try and the second thing that I look at is the back position and actually trying to go instead of see the big error where people try and start with a flat back and then they get to a point deep into where they're really pushing themselves, grinding out reps or whatever, that the torso position starts to move significantly under load as the bar's left the floor. And for me, that is, in my experience, like that has been the dangerous position where people tend to hurt themselves is where the back position is changing over load, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Is it the bar path that's slightly out in front that causes that, or is it the rounding as they move causing the bar path to move out in front? And they're both kind of feeding into each other, obviously, but. Like how do we offset the risk of that? And the way that I've found and been successful with some of the lifters that I coach, people like say Tim and Joe Daglish, for instance, and Shannon Smith, Shannon Clifford, who won OSG Worlds a couple of 2021. Like you watch the way that they pull, and you watch them from the side, and their bar path is immaculate. It's just a perfectly straight line. It's perfect. Every single time, regardless of whether they're lifting 20% or whether they're lifting 95%, it doesn't change. Yeah. But the thing what that they're both really strong with is that they're strong in a really kind of flex position. And when they're kind of grinding out reps, they used to go to this kind of really rounded position. Whereas I found that actually meeting somewhere in the middle is a re is often a or somewhere between the kind of flat position and excessively rounding, you'll have a lot more, like a lot of people will have a lot more success in maintaining a constant position throughout the pull. If yeah, I think that's a really beneficial for a lot of people to learn is optimize the bar path first, even if this means dropping the weight back down to so you can get that bar moving from A to B perfectly straight line, regardless of weight, and then lock in a back position and explore and find a torso position that doesn't change regardless of load. And a lot of people, especially if they hitch when they're going for maximal weights, instead of I actually think from a stance of I think people are maybe being a bit irresponsible if they're just leaving it till the maximal set or competition day, that they're going into these kind of they're going from an all right position into like an excessive like kind of like that makes me cringe. Where I find there can be like a nice middle ground where people can get locked in that. You know, if you people take the approach where I'm gonna go to that position anyway, how can we reduce the chance of me risking injury? And like I feel that like finding a position that you can lock in regardless of load is a massively, massively beneficial thing in terms of both performance and injury prevention. And then I think the thing to layer on top of this, which is often in a different order to what people teach in the UK, is once you've found this optimal bar path, you've found this back position that doesn't alter regardless of percentage that you lift in, then add the brace on top. So you're looking at bracing, in my opinion, should be like a almost like a performance enhancer thing that you're just providing that kind of extra global stability that allows you to lift more weight but doesn't alter the positioning. That's my philosophy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Where you're getting the skill and the positional awareness, you're building that first, And then when you're like, right, now I'm okay, now we start to learn how to brace. And that's why I find it so important that people in phases, like if you're an elite lifter, drop the weight back, work with like you can dial in these skills with like 40 to 50% of your max and dial in the number one and two. But beginners just starting off with starting off really, really light until you've got those first two things patterned on, until you get to the point where you find that it's challenging. So now we need another gear, then learn how to brace, and then learn how to say bring a belt to enhance that brace further. Whereas a lot of people can't seem to learn the I see a lot of people making the, I don't like to rubbish what other people are doing, but you see it a lot where people are trying to keep the back straight as number one, not even factoring in bar path, and then they get to a point where the back's aching because the bar path is so shit, but they think it's because the back needs some protection or whatever, so then they fucking put a belt on them. So then the belt is just enhancing this kind of global stability that's kind of hiding the thing that's the actual problem, which is the positioning and
I think you make a really good point there, not to interrupt, but like how many lifters do you see that could use a lot of like technique work? Like especially I see it like in the gym with like beginners and they use like I think what you're saying is too, they use like supportive gear as like band-aids. Like they get that belt and then they wear a soft belt under it and they throw on elbow sleeves and they throw on, all this stuff. So I definitely, I think that's a great point. I just wanted to kind of interject for a second because I know what you're saying there.
And like that's like if someone feels their back, for instance, on a deadlift, or like any lift, you feel a certain something that isn't quite right, a joint or whatever. Let's say the back in the deadlift, because that's what we're talking about. Like a lot of people's go-to is right, well, I need to put a belt on then or whatever. And don't get me wrong, I do think it's different depending on what phase that you're in. Say you, for instance, you're 3 weeks out from a meet and you're feeling your back a little bit, and it's not going to be the time realistically to fucking back off and work on technique beltless or whatever. It's going to be like, right, you know what you're doing, your bar path's good or whatever, you've got this little niggle, you're going to kind of push through. But I'm talking very often, which I'm not advocating, by the way. I'm just being real. Like that's what we do, isn't it? Whereas like an off-season phase, or even like say what I'll often do is somebody's like say the scenario where somebody's lifting pretty good weights and they've got a comp that's not in the not too distant future and they don't really want to interfere with that main session. Like I'll often put in like a secondary session where we'll put in like the first two things that are discussed about the bar path and the back position, and use this secondary session as like an explorative session. Like a protocol that I like is like 10 sets of five at say 40% to that can work well as like a if you train lower body, if you do some squats or whatever after your squats, dialing that in and exploring with technique. And I find that that's kind of a good kind of load to start with, where you're getting significant feedback in terms of technical learning. Like you're getting value from it, but the weight's light enough where you can make kind of micro adjustments in terms of, right, well, I'll try my feet here, I'll try my hands a little bit wider, I'll try shoulders over here. You can make these little tweaks, but without taking more from the recovery bank account, for instance. I think that's the kind of, I think that's a major area where a lot of people go wrong, is they want to, they've got like a technical flaw that they know, but they don't know how to address it without stealing from other things, I suppose. And that's a good way you can do it.
That makes sense.
And then look, I'll go overhead. Have you got time to listen to overhead for
Yeah,
10
of
minutes?
course. I need the most. I was gonna say do overhead for sure, because that's where I need the most help.
Yeah,
So,
we'll just do overhead, because I say 5 minutes, end
I
up
might
in
have
that.
some questions on this one too. So
Right,
I'm
cool. Yeah, we'll
excited
do
about.
overhead, and then you can ask my opinion on it, and we'll see if I can help you or whatever. So overhead, and I'm going to go over the main three kind of pillars that are that I teach. So bar path, right? And this is criminal how poor it is. Yeah, beginners, fine. But even all the way up to elite level, where I see people pressing logs and they're way out in front of them. And they're like, say, if you take a video from the side and you see people pressing a log and they're going, and it's going on an arc,
Yep.
right? And it's ridiculous. So then this kind of feeds into the only way to get better at that is by getting really, really strong in your upper body, so you can kind of get yourself out of jail, so to speak. But optimize the bar path. So straight line. Try and find it as close to a straight line from A to B as possible, from the shoulders to overhead. And a big thing that a lot of people don't even realize, and this might just people who can see this video, but if you can imagine like a log being wrapped here, right, and where the center of the pins are, so roughly here, whatever, yeah,
Yeah.
that's where the center of the mass of the log is. My finishing position is here, where my joints are stacked. So if you go from the center of the pin where it starts and the center of the pin when it's overhead, like, can you see the line?
Right. Yeah, way in front.
Well, it's actually back. It's actually
Oh,
back.
right. Oh, okay. I see what you're
Yeah,
saying.
yeah. So what a lot of people are making the error where they start here and then they fucking press it out in front and then
Yep.
kind of curve backwards. Yeah.
Gotcha. Makes
But they
sense.
think that the thing that they're seeking is, oh, well, I'll try and press it vertically and I'll try and get closer to there. Closer to the straight line, yeah? Whereas a lot of people will have a lot more success if they think of punching it back behind them. And this is like a game changer if you've never tried it.
Okay.
For the people who kind of feel like the log doesn't feel that heavy in the rack or the axle, and they drive, but then they just can't feel like they're strong enough to press out. And this symptom of they feel that the upper body isn't strong enough to finish the rep, so then they go and work on their upper body strength. Whereas actually, it's just fucking the bar path is tragic. Yeah, it's so poor. But so my point is, what I'm trying to lay out to you here is that if the center of and the logs are a really good example, because you can see this as clear as day, it's nowhere near a vertical line through the center of mass from the start position to the end position. It's actually back. Yeah, because
Right.
this should be a non-negotiable list. Like, we should all have enough shoulder flexion to get a position where the you see me lift the, like, say dumbbell, for instance, yeah, that you see me do, like 105 kilos last week, and I could have walked around the gym with it when it was overhead, yeah. And it's not because I'm a freak in terms of like muscle fibers or anything. I'm far from it. I'm just using my joints that are stacked on top of each other, yeah. My wrists on top of my elbow, top of my shoulders, top of my spine, etc. So if your lats and pecs are so tight that you can't fucking achieve shoulder flexion, like proper shoulder flexion, like not only are you gonna like you think you have the symptom of like struggling to hold your lockouts at comp, but you're not actually gonna be able to achieve this optimal bar path and keep the whatever load you're lifting as close to your center of mass as possible. So yeah, that should be a game changer. And in term for if we haven't if we if you're listening to this and like you haven't heard it before, like it's that straight, not only a straight line, but it's ever so slightly back, yeah, from the front rack to that joint stacked position. So the thing is, for us, I'm gonna put myself in this bracket as well. Us Instagram lifters, yeah. You put it up. We film our videos, generally speaking, from what's going to look good on Instagram. So you put your big log sets up, or a video from the front, my main set. Oh yeah, I'm an animal or whatever. Get myself in the full screen. Yeah, you can see the whole picture, but you can't see the bar path. So what I'm saying to if you're somebody who struggles with a bit of a grind when, say, the log or the axle is about chin height, face height, or whatever, analyze your bar path. Take your next overhead session where you're applying leg drive and video from the front and see, is the bar moving in a pretty much straight line? And is it going backwards? Not straight up, definitely not forward on that curve that a lot of people are doing, right up to a world's level. Yeah. Can we find that path where it's back? Because if you can, then that's where the magic's going to happen. And like all the other pointers feed into that. So like say Shane MST Systems, he always like his way of coaching this is like say he's always drilling the head back. So the head back position is making it easier for you to facilitate this line, because if your head's here, then you can it's easier to push into that space. Yeah, you've got nice space to push into, if you will. Yeah, a lot of some other people, I think. Camby? I spoke to Camby on a similar thing to this, and he one of his cues was that I use now with a lot of people is face up. So like actually keeping your face like on log, for instance, your face coming up like parallel to the ceiling, because then you'll provide yourself with this space that you can. You'll just give yourself an easier task to achieve this optimum bar path on log, for instance.
Right.
Or a final cue that's addressing the same thing that Dale McPherson or 3D Strength, a UK coach, he uses. He says on log, lock out your upper body before you bring your head through, or make sure you lock it out before you bring your head through, kind of thing. And the three cues are saying the same thing, basically. But they're feeding into this kind of giant pillar, which I try and talk about, which is they're all helping you achieve that they're all providing space and like a technical cue that, but fundamentally we're trying to achieve that thing of bar path from A to B. So I think if people actually listen to this and you think, fuck me, that makes sense, go and video your stuff from the side and see, be critical with yourself. Go 50, 60% to start off with, a couple of triples, yeah? And just assess, self-assess, right? Is that bar path what I described, or is it going out in front, or is it just straight up, yeah? Because the likelihood is that you're not an exception to the rule, yeah? And that this will work for you. So the second main point, once you've nailed the bar path, I think the number one reason why axles, dumbbells, logs are won or lost is the ability to dip and drive. I think the dip and drive, and basically you're like, we talk about rack position, but it's much beyond the rack position. It's about maintaining that rack position, not only as you dip, i.e. doing the eccentric or the way down, but as you do the concentric and you drive up. So you see a lot of people, though, say a lot of guys similar level to us or whatever, and the rack position looks pretty good, yeah? And they think that, why's my overhead shit? Right, but then they'll go to dip, and they might, a common area you see is people like hinging forward, yeah, and not keeping a vertical torso as they go to apply leg drive. So you can see it as clear as day as they go to dip, it's rolled forward, yeah? There's some other people who are a little bit better. They've got the rack position nailed. The dip looks really good. But then if you slow-mo the video, when they go and reverse the dip and go into the drive, that's when they lose it forward, yeah? So you need to highlight to yourself, right, which stage are you at? Which stage do you need to work at? Is you... And almost use them as prerequisites to each other. Yeah, you can't have a good dip and drive. You can't have a good drive without having a good dip. You can't have a good dip without establishing a decent rack position first. Yeah, so use them as prerequisites and feed into each other. And then, so that's the bit. Like, once the penny's dropped in terms of nailing the bar path, and you understand what you're going for on that. this is where I'll see most of you in terms of people's programming and practice, in terms of once they know that the bar path needs to be that, the practice needs to be at the dip and drive. That's where I'd say 90% of people's overheads are failing in strongman is the dip and drive. It's the same whether it's the log and they go like this and then the big elbow drop as they start to drive up. You see that? Yeah.
Right. See it all the, especially I see it people that are more green with log, newer with log, because it's such a cumbersome item. It's such a cumbersome thing that it's going to want to pull you forward versus like an axle or a barbell being able to comfortably sit back a little bit more. And even on an axle, the biggest thing that I see when I see athletes press is like more novice athletes, but their elbows dip. First thing, their elbows dip and everything goes forward and goes just to shit.
Yeah, 100%. So, and this is usually down to one or two things in terms of the let's talk from an intermediate lifter standpoint, an advanced lifter standpoint, right? So I'd say most beginners fail and the log rolls because of they don't know how to dip and they just fucking hinge forward. Does that make sense? You see the torso collapse. Basically, learn how to do the vertical torso. But then you see these big batch of like intermediate to advanced lifters who are lifting big weights, doing well at competitions. But then they've learned the value of the maintaining the vertical torso, but then their elbows are still dropping and they're scratching the head. They're like, why the fuck? Why is this happening? Why are my elbows dropping when it gets heavy? My vertical torso, I'm applying leg drive, feel strong, do whatever. And a lot of the time that I see is actually because they're having, which is against what the cue that you learn when you're getting into strongman is everybody says elbows high, elbows high, elbows high. Whereas I find that a lot of people are trying to dip and drive with their elbows in this weak position where they're trying to go really high, or basically getting confused with like say using your axle example, people doing like a kind of front squat rack position. And then trying to press from there. And if you're trying to press from that, especially as the weight goes up, your elbows, if you slow-mo it, if most people, if they're starting here and they're going to dip and drive from there, as they drive, their elbows will drop, usually to around this kind of range. So what I would say is a lot of people who have a lot more success actually not necessarily trying to keep their elbows high, like actually just getting their elbows in a position that they going back, similar to the deadlift principle. What I'm saying is that as they go to drive and apply leg drive, the position that their elbows want to be in at that position as they go to drive to achieve this optimal bar path, actually learn to start in that position, and you'll have a lot greater success because this thing of trying to start here. And even if they only drop to there, it's not only the fact that your elbows are dropping to there, you're losing the bar path a little bit by your elbows dropping subtly, but it's the fact that the subtly dropping is like they're actually taking momentum into that position. Whereas if you actually just start here, most people will have a lot more success in maintaining that as they go to apply leg drive. Exactly the same principle with log, exactly the same principle with so it's exactly the same principle, so long as you're factoring in the first thing that I said, which is optimizing the bar path as the non-negotiable. Yeah. And it's the same thing on the dumbbell. How often do you see it where people doing the dumbbell that I get it asked, or people ask me all the time, it fucking does my head in, where people are like, right, so-and-so's told me to put my elbow or whatever. Should I be putting my elbow high here? And I'm like, forget about your elbow. Forget your elbow's even there, right? You should be finding, like, say, on a dumbbell, you should be finding a position where, and this is where you analyze a little bit differently from the log and the axle, analyze from the front and like make sure that your dumbbell's aligned with your center of mass down the front, or like basically, like if you drew a line through the center of mass of the dumbbell, like you should be in the middle of your feet. Whereas you find what most people will do is they'll rack it on one side, and if you drew like the center of mass through the dumbbell, it's going to be like say 70-30 towards the side leg that the dumbbell's on, if that makes sense. So they're giving themselves so that's the error, and it's the same sequence of they haven't got the rack position sorted yet. So if they go to dip and drive on that, where's the dumbbell going to go if it starts over here? It's just going to fucking go over there, and it's an impossible task. So yeah, basically trying to find that central position where the dumbbell is racked on your, let's say, your torso. Some people trap, some people a little bit lower down or whatever. Just find a position where it's dead, where your joints are stacked, and then see where your elbow is. And that's where it should be. Like, don't try and point. Some days it might even change from day to day, but it's definitely different from person to person. I've seen awesome dumbbell presses that I coach who have elbow here, some have elbows up here, some have elbows here. Like, stop thinking about the elbow and actually just think about this optimal rack position. And then the other position to improve would be, once you've done the strong dip and drive, is develop the overhead stability. And this is a neglected thing in strongman, and it's like weightlifting 101, isn't it? Like, where people can the just the thing that a weightlifter say is trust your skeleton, or basically the saying is stack your joint. So basically, if you're in a position, say I'm stood up here and I've got an axle here, I lock out all my wrists, my elbows, my shoulders, etc. Your muscles can disengage significantly because you're relying on your skeleton structure to take that load. Whereas if you're, say, too inflexible to achieve that position, like, you're just gonna get smoked and not gonna be able to hold the weight. So yeah, you learn about the di optimizing your dip and drive and the overhead stability, and then you're gonna have that's gonna tie really well into that first thing of being able to achieve that bar path. And then the final pillar on the overhead stuff is you need to decide. And by the way, like, obviously, for anybody who follows me, like, I'll split jerk, I'll do different jerk variations as my kind of strongest variation, but I do not force feed this to clients. Like, it takes to do thousands and thousands and thousands of reps with lightweights to accumulate the skill to even be okay at it, really. Whereas if you don't have as much time to put into it, and you want in some quicker returns, but maybe won't be quite as high in the long term, like, then just focusing on strengthening your upper body and actually coupling your this awesome bar path with a strong dip and drive with upper body strength, i.e., like, say you're really good at driving and extending to here, so then you've got particularly, I'd say, tricep strength and lockout strength. To that, the, then you're going to do well. What I would say is that so basically, you pick between the two approaches that I'm laying out here: either upper body strength, if you're committing to kind of getting your pressing strength to basically do the business when you've run out of your dip and drive, or you can swap that upper body strength for lower body coordination in terms of receiving, i.e., rebending the knees. And, like, basically, you've got two options when you finish the dip and drive. You've got to go either there, or you've got to go boom down underneath it. So you can talk power jerks, jumping out, split jerks in a split stance or whatever. But if you get good at the jerks, there's less of a requirement for your upper body strength to be high. And you'll have great success with that. Ideally, if you have lots and lots of time, get good at them both. But in terms of getting the biggest returns, like, I've done exceptionally well in terms of a competitor in, say, national level competitions or whatever, on overhead, whilst not even when I won that England's Strongest Man in 2021, I actually, because obviously I pride myself on experimenting on myself, I stopped at, I think it was 2 years where I didn't do any upper body training, as in, like, I didn't do any upper body training whatsoever. And I'm not advocating this, but I just focused on getting my legs strong and then stronger in terms of stuff like front squats and dips and stuff like that, and then improved my skill on jerks and my leg drive and stuff. Like I did n zero strict pressing in 2 years, zero strict pressing, zero any kind of isolation, bicep, triceps. I didn't do even do any kind of rows or even like say shoulder stabilization work and stuff like that, because I feel that if you do the other stuff really well, you do your skill work right, you can actually tie you can get better at the skill of, you know, say jerking for instance, but you can also, if you practice with an appropriate load, you can get all the shoulder stability work, the overhead stability, the open up position and stuff. And yeah, like since when I took that approach, I was probably the most mobile, most flexible that I've ever been in my life. The day that I won that comp, I did 122 kilos for 8 reps, barbell clean and jerk, to win the event, the overhead event at England's Strongest Man. And that was, I probably couldn't bench 100 kilos at the time. I probably couldn't bench 220 at the time. Like it's
Wow.
just, whereas nowadays, I'm training upper body, I'm benching, I'm building my, like just because I'm finding it fun and I'm training a bit more. But I mean, in terms of like that, I've like say built quite a lot of strength in my upper body, raw strength, let's say, in the last 6 months. But I haven't seen like a significant return on terms of the top end numbers on my log, dumbbell, and axle. So what I'm saying is like I'm going off the greatest returns. So yeah, in summary, for the overhead bar path, optimize that first. Think where the center of mass is, where it starts and where it finishes. It's ever so slightly back, and it's more extreme with the log. Yeah, because it starts out further in front, but the stack position is the same. Strong dip and drive, that's where you're going to get most of your returns, whether you're not a jerk or whether you're just a push presser or whatever, like optimizing your dip and drive and bar path, video from the front, build your overhead stability. I've never done anything fancy for building overhead stability. I'm not one for like doing, say, you know, mobility drills, banded lat stretch, pecs, like for the sake of it, unless it's like needed for somebody. Like I think the best way to build overhead stability is hold your fucking lockout, like in training. And so a way that I'll do this is, like I'll very often do the last rep of a working set. I'll hold for overhead for 5 to 10 seconds, and I'll try and find that joint stack position. And I'll find that for a lot of people, that's a brilliant time efficient way of building something that's specific in terms of skill that's going to help your overhead. And actually how that weight feels over your head. But you're going to get this, you have to develop your lat flexibility. You're going to have to keep those pecs supple. But also you're not only just opening up the positions, you're building adequate specific stability in those positions as well. So your shoulder stabilizers are all getting worked in this kind of thing. And then final thing would be upper body versus your lower body coordination. Have you got the patience to learn jerks or whatever? Like if you're coached by me, you know, like I'm never going to force feed people jerks, but if people want to learn them, then we do it. And then train the upper body to be the icing on the cake. Whereas I see a lot of people getting into strongman and even like say see strongman programming now where people will do a 4 day split and then one of the days will be like an upper body static pressing day where they'll be doing like fucking bench, incline bench and a load of upper body assistance work as like one of like basically a quarter of their training week. And I just think it's like I think the time could be used a lot more efficiently. So
Yeah.
what about your overhead? What's your take on what I've just said, and what's your limiting factor, do you think?
I'm not sure. I think just technique and just hammering it more and more, like getting more and more comfortable with implements. Because like still in the grand scheme of things, like I am still kind of new-ish with log, axle, it on a more like top end level. But no, I think that's really, really good. I think that's interesting stuff too. I like biggest takeaway is like for stability to just hold reps longer. Like instead of doing all this fancy stuff, I thought that was really interesting that you said that too. So I'm not sure. I'm gonna go to the drawing board and try to.
Well, tell you what, send me over a couple of videos
I will. I will, man. I appreciate that. I thought that was some good coaching there at the end too. I hope people kind of listen to that and comment, ask Josh whatever questions and we'll try to get them answered too. So
We'll do that with it as a little experiment for your, like, you send me some videos and your overhead, and then I'll
yeah.
respond with how I would respond. It's up to you whether you do it or not, but if
Yeah,
you
no,
decide.
that's a great idea.
If you decide to implement what I've said and some of the suggestions and that, then you can document it in a few weeks or a month and
Yeah.
see if there's any improvement.
Cool.
Or see if
Let's
there's
do it.
not. Say you've done everything that Josh suggested and he's talking shite. It don't work.
No,
Seriously.
I like it. I'm gonna send you some videos. We'll do that. We'll post them. So
Nice one, mate.
awesome, man. Well, Josh, thank you so much for coming on, man. First guest outside of America. So get some people from across the pond listening.
Nice one. Thank you very much.
Awesome, man. Thank you so
Peace.
much.
Peace. See ya.